All right, folks, welcome to Lecture 40. In this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class, we were to have had an extended writing tutorial again today based on our discussion from yesterday pertaining to this link here, on the which is now present on the Lecture 40 resources. However, due to my oversight, that didn't make it on there until this morning. So it wouldn't have been possible for you guys to actually do the homework that I wanted you to do. So all we can do there is put it off one more day. So I would like you guys to, now that it's there, no more excuses. Not that you had any, it's my fault. So now that it's there, you have the passage that needs to be integrated. And so it's on the class webpage. So let's talk about that tomorrow. And write yourself a note or whatever to be in a position to do that. I know. And by the way, if things don't show up on the class webpage, it's sometimes nice for me to get an email that says, Mr. Powell, you promised that you would put something on the class webpage, but you didn't. So that could be helpful. I'd appreciate any help you can give me in that regard. If I happen to be asleep at the wheel, you can help me to keep things running properly. Okay, but anyway, they are there now. The paragraphs and the assignment material is there now. So let me know if you need further guidance on that. If you want to review the assignment, let me know. But otherwise, let's just proceed. And today, we're going to talk about Jamestown, the first settlement, the first successful settlement of America by the English. And so this is unequivocally an anchor fact of American history. And so that's why I rarely emphasize dates in our discussions, except for ones that I think are really important. And so I'm putting it right here in our title, Jamestown 1607. And so you can rest assured that this date will be part of your anchor fact assignments moving forward. Because we are talking about now, I mean, here's, you know, we're going to be talking about detailed stories of this and that, this colony, that colony, this person succeeding in doing this or that. And like in any other time that you study in history, it's very easy to just get caught up in the details and, well, lose sight of why you should even care. And so, and this has an impact on every single person that studies history. There's no way to escape this problem of the relevance of what you're studying and whether or not you actually know that what you're studying is relevant. It's such a fascinating thing to me, because if a lot of people, and you can decide whether you belong to this group or not, okay? There's pretty much two different kinds of students of history. I know that's an oversimplification. You know how sometimes people say, there's two kinds of people in this world. Well, in a sense, there really are two kinds of students of history in this world. One kind is the student that is, has a general kind of desire to know about history and has retained an interest in it. And that student is likely to be one who will listen to a history lecture or read a history book and get into it and forget all about the so what. So, in other words, we'll just enjoy it. It's almost like reading a history book is like reading a novel. It's just an experience that where you're learning stuff and it's interesting. It seems to be about human beings and their adventures and their successes and failures in the world. And it's just kind of got an intrinsic interest for you, and you get into it, and people like that end up becoming historians or some other kind of intellectual, because it's just, these things are interesting to them. And so if you're that kind of person, it's very easy to just get into a history story and immerse yourself in the ocean of facts and lose sight of land altogether. And so at that point, and this is the way most historians are nowadays, they're really expert at all kinds of things about the past, but they couldn't tell you for the life of them what they have to do with anything today. And it doesn't even occur to them to think that there should be a reason for studying these facts, other than that they're enjoyable. The thing is, history is not art. It's not. It's true. It's happened, and it shaped our world. So it's a whole different pursuit than art. History is a science. It's a social science about how human beings live and how they can succeed and fail in the world. And so studying it like it's an art is a big mistake. You're not getting out of it what you should be because you're not doing it properly. And so you could be one of these people that will get into the story of Jamestown and then get into the story of Plymouth and the story of Pennsylvania and the story of Maryland. And yeah, there's lots of colonies to study, and you can get lost in that story and never think, what is the so what? So you can check that box off in your personal kind of perspective. If you think you would be somebody susceptible to that, then you have to watch out for that, because you can end up studying a whole bunch of useless stuff and becoming a person who actually kind of is committed to that, which is really weird, but it happens. And you could just become a person who likes to collect a whole bunch of useless information. Which, like I said, I mean, I'm putting it in kind of an ungenerous sort of way, but that's the truth of it, is that historians are collectors of a whole bunch of useless stuff all too often. There are some who are capable of better than that. Now, on the other hand, you might be the other kind of person who is not sold on history, doesn't have a tendency to get completely intrigued. And remember that story, we were looking at the painting, and was it Declan who gave us the word captivated? Right? You're not the kind of person who's going to be captivated by history. You, on the other hand, are the kind of person who is going to start listening to a history story, and you will find yourself tuning out. So, you're one or the other. Are you the captivated audience, or are you the tuning out audience when it comes to history? It's got to be one or the other, right? I really think it is a legitimate either or situation. So just in your own mind, you don't have to confess. You don't have to worry about being seen as a good or bad person by me if you happen to be one or the other. I think both are completely legitimate. Both are wrong, but both are completely legitimate. So think about where you would kind of normally fall. Would you normally just kind of be captivated by history no matter what? Or are you the kind of person that finds themselves usually tuning out when it comes to these stories? Now, the antidote to both of those is the most important question. The end is always to approach history starting with a demand, a personal command to the historian to say, if you're going to tell me something, it better matter. The antidote to both the disproportionate interest in things that don't matter, and then on the other hand, complete lack of interest in history, is so what? It's getting your mind properly oriented to the past. It's being true to yourself in demanding that history give you something worthwhile. Now, I'm still waiting. It hasn't happened yet. I'm still waiting for somebody to raise their hand one day in class while I'm blabbing about something, and somebody to raise their hand and to say, Mr. Powell, who cares? I'm still waiting for that. That's going to be my... I dream about that moment where somebody has got the guts to say that and is willing to kind of say to me, Mr. Powell, you're talking about a whole bunch of stuff about the past, and you haven't really sold me on the fact that it matters. And I'm willing to tell you, Mr. Powell, that that's the way things are right now. So can you help me out here? So who cares? Who cares, right? And so when it comes to all of this stuff we're about to study, these colonies, there is a huge who cares, which is why Jamestown is an anchor in history. So what's the motivation for studying this as a person living 400 years down the line plus? What's the motivation for studying this? Well, once again, the fundamental one is Jamestown is a part of how we got to where we are. The world we live in was shaped by this. This, Jamestown, is the first successful colony in the Americas by England. Now, the so what is huge. Because if the English hadn't succeeded, well, there would be no United States of America. Nothing about what you think life is would even exist. The English had continued to fail in their efforts at colonization and maybe given up on it. They said, it's too cold in America. We're not going to go there. And instead focused on the Caribbean. Something like that. Right? Focused on South America or something. The whole history of the world would be different. There'd be no United States of America. So as far as the story that we're studying and the success of the Jamestown colony, this is how our world came to be. These people built it. And in a way, you cannot know where you are. You literally cannot know where you are living if you don't know this story. You'll be like a person whose awareness of the world is completely superficial and unanchored if you don't know about the story of Virginia. And I would go so far as to say, if you don't make a pilgrimage to Virginia at some point in your life, you're not really a full American. You do not know what America is if you haven't been there. If you haven't been to Jamestown, you haven't been to Williamsburg, if you haven't been to Yorktown, if you haven't been to Thomas Jefferson's house called Monticello, if you haven't been to see Patrick Henry's house, George Washington's house, and so on, you haven't quite made it yet. You don't know where it is that you're living. Because this is America. So that's the motivation to me. I hope it's a good in-between motivation that helps you. If you're a person who has a tendency to just get captivated by facts, that hopefully now you're back in the correct mindset, which is, so what? This is where America comes from. And on the other hand, if you're the kind of person who finds themselves susceptible to tuning out in history and you're like, well, the facts by themselves are not that interesting, then hopefully you're also like, okay, all right, this is why we're studying this. Without Jamestown, there's no United States of America. So what does that say? What are we going to learn about our world by studying the Jamestown colony and the Virginia colony? Well, Let's go find out. But basically, you know, the reason why we're doing this is to understand our world. And so let's get back to our scenario where we found ourselves the last time. This is cool. Let me show you guys this painting. This is a painting by a famous American painter, Albert Bierstadt. Beautiful landscape painting. It's a painting of not a settlement, but of a very temporary settlement by Bartholomew Gosnold, the man who was who's an important colonizer, starting the Virginia Company. So he came to America as an explorer in the early 1600s, I think about 1602 or something like that. And this is a place in Massachusetts called, the name of it is really funny, something like Kittyhunk. Is it right there on the top of my screen? Yeah, Kittyhunk. Kittyhunk is a place in Massachusetts, very beautiful island. And they settled there and they looked around and they found all kinds of cool stuff. And said, okay, we're gonna try to get a permission from the King of England to go and make colonies here. And so, yeah, it's very pretty and it just gives you a sense. It kind of idyllic, of course, but it's a nice little landscape painting and it captures the dawn of a new age in a sense, right? With the sun shining on the sails and the people coming ashore and, you know, it's nature, right? It's the deer are there, the geese are there, and it's a beautiful, beautiful scene. So anyhow, Gosnold and others were thinking of creating colonies. The project of colonization had failed for over 20 years. And so, well, you've got to, if you want to make one, you've got to go to the king and you've got to get permission. So here's, you know, painting, decent painting by an artist named Jean-Léon Jérôme Ferris, an American artist. It's not a brilliant painting, but it's a good one. And it captures this moment where a colonizer is presenting all these legal papers to the king. And the king is sitting there all high and mighty in his nice chair, and he's being served by some kind of Arab servant, and he's surrounded by his courtly ladies and gentlemen and so on, and advisors in his beautiful palace. And the guy's stepping up, and he's presenting the documents, which are the charter, the permission slip required to go and colonize. Right, so one of the things about Jamestown and one of the things about American colonization is that we're still not living in a free world. If you want to go do something like this, you've got to get permission from the king, and he's going to say, basically because the king owns everything. It's the king's. If you live in a monarchy, everything belongs to the king. By definition. And what he does is he grants it to you. So once English explorers had started going to the Americas, basically the King of England said, that's mine. All of that is mine. And so now if you want to go colonize and make a better life for yourself, before you can even do that, you've got to get permission from the king. So off they went and so in 1606, a set of charters was granted by the king. And I've got a map here to show you kind of how the arrangements were made. In 1606, the king granted two charters. One to the London Company, which is labeled down here, the London Company of Virginia. And another one to the Plymouth Company of Virginia. So hopefully you recognize this chart, right, of the way that the East Coast lines up. If you need to, you kind of look across back and forth because it's the same area. And the map shows you on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, the map shows you where the states are. And it gives you a kind of 400-year interval, right? From 1606 all the way to 2006, right? About 8 years ago, it shows you what the king did, which is pretty cool because there's all kinds of interesting lines that connect up with where things are today compared to where things were before. So what the king said was, you guys with the Plymouth Company, you get to make colonies anywhere in between this line, 45, and 38. Anywhere between 45 and 38. And then the king gave another charter and to the London Company, and he said, you guys can make a colony anywhere you want between 34 and 41. And so this was kind of an attempt by the king to do something here, because evidently the two charters overlapped. The London Company's charter was from 34 to 41. The Plymouth Company's charter is from 45 to 38. So everything here in gray was granted to both. So this was just a kind of clever attempt by the king to get them to compete. What he said was, you guys, London Company, you can do anything you want up to 41. And you guys, Plymouth Company, you can do anything you want down to 38. However, you can't make a settlement within 100 miles of the other company. So, of course, what he was trying to do there was to make it a race. Trying to get them to compete to settle there and hopefully finally solve this problem. Finally solve this problem of colonization, because in the meantime, the Spanish are down in the Caribbean and the climate down there is not so bad and they are taken over. And the French are coming. They're also going to compete for this land. If the English don't claim this, wow. If the English do not claim this, all of history is different. If they don't succeed, the entire world, the history of the entire world changes radically. Because it becomes the United States of France, the United States of New France, or it becomes the United States of New Spain. There's no England here. There's nothing that's going to lead to the United States, which is a shocking thought. So thank goodness the king is granting these permissions to these people and saying, get out there and compete and make colonies. Well, now, easier said than done, though. The first voyage of the settlers coming to Jamestown, there were 100 colonists. So we get back to our painting of the colonists arriving. Right here they are arriving in the Americas on board their three ships. I can't remember the names of the three ships. There was one called the Godspeed and one called the Susan Constant. And then there was another one. But anyway, not as famous as Columbus's three ships. But there were three ships and 100 colonists on board heading for they called Virginia, and 16 of them died on the voyage. So just try to take in that statistic to appreciate what the challenge, the level of challenge was. 16 of them died on the voyage. So I mean, it's we don't live in a time where it's easy for us to conceive of this level of fragility of human life, because we live in an era of technology where we have command of nature, where we get inside of steel tubes and fly through the air at hundreds of miles an hour, and we expect that pretty much 100% of the time we're going to get where we want to go safely. I mean, nowadays, air travel and international travel are so safe. They're way safer than getting in your car. Statistically speaking, it's almost 100% safety record. It's amazing. Would you get in a plane to go to London if out of 100 passengers, out of every 100 passengers, 16 would be dead by the time you get across? Could you imagine living in such a time? So only 84 of them actually made it to this spot, and then what do they have happen? And then what do they have happen? Well, they're starting to encounter the native people. I wish we had a really good photograph of this painting. But we don't. This is the best I could find on the internet. If I ever get a chance to go to this place called Woola Rock, I don't actually know very well where this is. But it's a great painting. It depicts an important moment in the settlement of the Jamestown colony, which some of you might be familiar with. The colonists arrived, and why did they start building a fort right away? Well, because this is funny. Why did they start building a fort right away? Well, because they had encountered already by this point two different tribes, and had, well, violent encounters with both. And this, for the benefit of those of you who are in the high school and aren't going to get the notes here, they had encountered a tribe called the Chesapeakes. They had encountered tribes called the Paspahegs. And shortly as they were constructing this settlement as well, and not long after, they would encounter a tribe called the Palmonkeys. And all of these tribes, all of them were very small tribes, but all of them were tributaries to the main tribe of the region, who were known as the Powhatans. So, not only was it incredibly difficult just to navigate through nature's challenges, but once they got there, they found primitive people still living in basically the Stone Age, and organized in really, really small tribes. So now, how are they going to figure out how to relate to these people? The Europeans themselves had lived through long tribal history of wars between them. They had their own tribal kind of outlook. English people didn't like French people, didn't like Spanish people, didn't like Germans, and so on. And now they're coming to a place in the world that's thousands of years behind them in terms of development of civilization. And the people there are organized in little tribes again. And, well, they know what that's like. There's nothing special about this kind of tribe versus that kind of tribe. It's always the same deal. The natives were large, extended, you know, groups of extended families, pretty much in conflict with each other, and typical relationship between them was, all right, you guys are over in that spot and we're over in this spot, and hopefully we don't run into each other too much, because if we do, we'll have to see who's the strongest. And so when they arrived, like I said, the settlers had their conflicts with the Chesapeakes and then the Paspahegs. So they're going to build a fort because they need to be safe. And then the leader of the expedition, named Captain John Smith, or one of the leaders of the expedition, who's depicted in this painting, is going to encounter the Paw Monkeys, who are going to capture him. And they're going to take him to Chief Powhatan, this character right here, who is, well, it's hard to come up with the right term in a very primitive context. We don't want to use the wrong terms here. But the Powhatans, basically, I think the right term is Powhatan was the chieftain of the region. And so I think the right term for, the best term for what this area was in terms of all of the different tribes put together, it was a chieftaincy. And so the Paw Monkeys captured this invader from Europe, brought him to Powhatan and said, what are we going to do? They're building a fort. They're moving in on our territory. Well, it's pretty obvious what Powhatan's going to do. Nothing against him, nothing against anybody in the story, right? Very classic. You guys know what the story is? Can you detect? If you don't already know the story, do you know what's going on in the painting? I wish we could do this one in History Through Art. But what does the painting show us? Okay.
When his armor is about to bash someone's head in.
Yeah, almost. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Is we're not even dealing with a man in his armor here. The truth being, I mean, the natives were nowhere near the level of development that the Egyptians had reached in 3000 BC. So we're not even there yet. I mean, there's no way that these people would ever have been recorded by history if it were not for the Europeans being there. So the natives of America were living in complete prehistorical conditions. I don't know when, if and when they ever would have emerged from those. Tens of thousands of years down the line, they had a really primitive society with the most basic kind of animistic beliefs about the world. Hard to imagine them moving beyond that. So, I mean, people did in other parts of the world, so maybe at some point they would too. Or maybe it would be the Aztec Empire that would have moved up and conquered them, and gradually they would have civilized. I mean, it would have been a long, torturous story. But yeah, this is not even a man in his armor. This is way beyond that. Although you're right to make the comparison. All right? But it's on a totally much more minute, much more insignificant scale. But it's something like that. It's something like, you know, the tribal leader of the Visigoths or whatever, defending his land or something like that. But it's hard for us to understand because it's even further back in terms of prehistorical development. It's just a tribal leader defending his land. But then on top of that, right, and that's what this guy is, he's the executioner, right? The guy with the big club is supposed to bash John Smith's head in. But does anybody know the famous story? What's happening? I mean, you can tell what's happening from the painting. But does anybody heard the story in terms of before, Declan?
That Pocahontas put her head on top of John's
to
protect him.
And who's Pocahontas?
The woman.
Yes, indeed. But do you remember what her role was in this society?
She was the daughter of the chief.
Yeah, right. She's the daughter of the chieftain. So she's jumping in here as this execution is about to be carried out. She's jumping in and putting herself in between John Smith and the executioner. And she's going to beg for his life. So this is a fascinating kind of romantic story attached to the settlement of Jamestown. the relationship between Pocahontas and John Smith, and then later on with other people. Pocahontas is a kind of fascinating character, and she's made it into Disney movies and everything. And so she's kind of a fascinating character in terms of early history. To me, what she represents is an individual who has a little bit more clarity, a little bit more of a good nature than everybody else around her. And what happens to a person like that in uncivilized times? And so she's just, kind of, I mean, somewhat heroic person for saving John Smith and saying, no, we shouldn't live this way. We shouldn't conduct ourselves this way. And as a result, you know, he's going to survive and he's going to play a very important role in the Jamestown colony. He's going to be one of the ones responsible for the colony not being completely wiped out. Well, the relationships between the colonists and the natives are going to continue to deteriorate over time, because what's going to happen is, as the colony succeeds, well, that just reinforces for them the fact that these people are here to stay, and, well, they are impinging on the lands that they want to control, these natives want to control. And, well, in a tribal context, it's pretty straightforward what happens then. You try to kill your enemies. You try to get rid of them. Because there's only so much room and only so much stuff. And what were the chances of them moving in a spot where nobody was going to be bothered by it? Here they weren't. So we'll get to this story. I mean, part of the conflicts and everything between them. But we know what happens. History swept these people aside because they were far more primitive than the Europeans coming over. They just were not going to be able to organize themselves in a way that they could stand up for themselves and push the Europeans out. It's just not something they could have ever done. So it's very inevitable, but and in some ways kind of tragic, but it is what it is. So John Smith is going to go back. He's going to be saved. And different times of this in the story, the Powhatans and their tributary tribes are going to be more or less respectful of the English. And it's going to be kind of a tense relationship. But it's going to be just horrible for the English anyway. I mean, there's a reason why colonization took so long to succeed. By 1609, 2 years after the establishment of Jamestown, 2 years after they're doing this, by this point, 500 colonists had been transported across to the Americas, to Jamestown. Within the first 2 years of the settlement, 500 colonists had been transported across, and 60 were left. So, we're talking, 88% die-off rate. of 500 colonists within the first 2 years were dead. 88% die-off rate in the colonization of Jamestown in the first 2 years. So, well, it's amazing that it's going to succeed at all. Like, I can't imagine how bad things were in England that they could get colonists to come over. That life was pretty hard, and sometimes people were desperate enough that they could come over. And I'm sure they hid this fact from everybody that they recruited. Right? I'm sure the colonizers were not fully honest with colonists, because if you put an ad in the paper and you said, I want colonists, I'm a colonizer. I have a ship, and I'm going to bring 100 of you over, and we're going to settle you in Jamestown. Are you going to put in bold font, are you going to put it in the fine print? You know, like nowadays everything's in the fine print, with a star, and then it's down at the bottom, and it says 12% survival rate. You're going to put that in your newspaper ad? It's free, but 12% survival rate. Whoa! They're not going to get a lot of colonists to go to Jamestown if that's the percentages. Right? So, not so great. And so, how are they going to succeed? How is there going to be... How are we going to get in America? You can't get an America out of a Jamestown with a 12% survival rate. Something's got to change, right? There's got to be a qualitative change to this life because it's just not the math that would allow you to succeed. So tomorrow we'll talk about, after we have our writing tutorial, which will include the connection exercise, right, on that narrative. Then we'll talk about this, the success of Jamestown. How did colonization actually succeed? And it's connected, very closely connected to how ultimately we're going to get to the American Revolution. Alrighty, so that does it for today. You can ponder whether, is there anything that we do nowadays that has a 88% die-off rate? It's hard to imagine, right? Really, we live in such, we're so advanced now by comparison. It's really staggering. But that's part of appreciating what American history is all about, and who made America are these people who survived these odds and who managed to build colonies despite these odds. It's incredibly heroic. All right, thanks, folks. We'll pick this up tomorrow. Bye for now.